Hello, and welcome to the America Podcast for the week of April 22nd. This is Luke Hansen, Associate Editor of America. For this week's podcast, I spoke with Professor Scott Hahn by telephone. Dr. Hahn is the Michael Scanlon Chair of Biblical Theology and the New Evangelization at Franciscan University of Steubenville, Ohio, and his latest book is Consuming the Word, published by Doubleday. Dr. Hahn is the author of this week's cover story in America. It is titled Mass Evangelization, Sharing Faith with the Eucharist.
Professor Hahn, thank you for joining me.
It's great to be with you, Luke.
Before jumping into our connection between the Mass and evangelization, I'd like to briefly ask you about your backstory. Because in the article you wrote that, as a teenager, you were a born-again Christian. When did you become Catholic, and what prompted that conversion?
Okay, I became a Catholic in 1986 at the age of 28. I had finished seminary, and I'd gone on into the ministry as a Presbyterian pastor. But after less than 2 years, I had sort of begun a search for a church that met what I was finding in the Fathers. And so, you know, I experienced the grace of a young adult conversion at 14, about 14 years earlier, and I needed it desperately, at least as far as my parents were concerned. I was in the Allegheny County Juvenile Court System in Pittsburgh, and experienced the grace of conversion through Young Life, an incarnational approach to youth ministry, where my Young Life leader would just kind of reach out to where we were in the high school and just immerse himself in our culture through friendship and all. It was really fun. But over the years, as an evangelical, as a Presbyterian, as a sort of Calvinist, I became, well, I wanted the truth, frankly, and I became convinced that the Catholic Church had it. And I mean, it sounds like a title and not a story, but I mean, for me, it was reading well over 100 books after I'd graduated at the top of my class from seminary, but suddenly I felt really dumb, but hungry, because I had never heard of men like Daniel Liu and de Lubach, and I suddenly began to devour these writings, the Bible and the Liturgy by Daniel Liu, Catholicism by de Lubach, Journet's Church of the Word Incarnate, Congar, Divided Christendom. And then I came across another guy, Durwell, on the resurrection, doing biblical theology. And my topic had always been covenant. And then this Jesuit named Dennis McCarthy nailed it better than my favorite scholars. And I was just on a roll. It was sort of like, how can these Catholics not only deepen theology more than my favorite professors, but just broaden my horizons with sacred scripture? I also, I mean, for me, it was sort of like an array of authors I'd never heard of, and then just began to learn so much from. Chabon, The Mysteries of Christianity, just swept me off my feet. A guy I'd never heard of before by the name of Ratzinger, his introduction to Christianity also really impressed me. And, you know, so I began to, you know, read all of these people, but then finally made my way into the documents of Vatican II and just felt my mind and heart ravished by Lumen Gentium, by Dei Verbum. And, you know, it might sound like a dramatic accumulation of titles and authors, but really the truth is that the narrative in my own experience was propelled as much by personal friendship as by, you know, scholars and propositions. And I think that's sort of the backstory that's kind of hard to narrate, because along the way, I just kept meeting Catholics who just were great at forming friendships and using that as the context for answering questions and just sharing experiences.
One of the ways that you described yourself as a teenager was as an earnest evangelical, eager to argue the world and to seeing the truth that was so plain to you. And some, I think, might criticize evangelization simplistically as doing just that, you know, simply arguing the world and seeing the truth that's so plain to us Catholics. So I'm wondering if your journey to Catholicism or other factors have changed your approach to evangelization and, you know, what you see as the task of evangelization today.
You know, Catholics tend to evangelize, in my experience at least, through friendship. And I learned that firsthand. And I have to say, in retrospect, it really stood somewhat in contrast to the way that I was trained to evangelize as an evangelical. We were taught the four spiritual laws, you know, which are true for Protestants and Catholics and everybody else for that matter. I mean, number one, God loves us. Number two, we've sinned. Number three, Christ has died for that sin. And number four, we've got to decide what to do through faith to accept that gift. And we could share that, you know, in a you know, on a bus or descending on an airplane or descending on a elevator. And we could get through that and lead them in a prayer. And there was really no need for a relationship afterwards. It was over and done. And yet at the same time, I have to admit that when I came to that kind of young adult conversion, it wasn't just through these four propositions or any additional ones. It was through the friendships that had been formed with these guys who enjoyed, who didn't just believe, but they enjoyed what it was they believed and shared it in that kind of joyful way. And so I just sort of went off in a search for more of that. And, I felt as, I felt like, how do I put this? When I became a Catholic back in 86, I had been an evangelical, but when I became a Catholic, I felt like the good news just went to the next level. I didn't sense that I had to cease to be an evangelical in order to become a Catholic. I just followed the good news into the deep and found that it just led me into the sacraments, into this communion that was really a place where friendship could be fostered even more than I found it in my earlier experience.
I found that your article was really helpful in setting the context for the new evangelization and how that developed in the thinking and teachings of recent popes. But one thing I'm wondering about, it seems like just about any evangelization effort from Catholics today can be labeled as part of the new evangelization. And I'm wondering if the term is really that inclusive, or if there's something like very distinctive about the new evangelization and what actions could be considered under that umbrella term?
That's a good question, because I think the new evangelization, like any priority or any program, can run the risk of becoming sort of like ecclesiastical jargon. So we have to take a step back and look at what it means. John Paul and Benedict made it clear that the Church has never ceased to evangelize, but the primary evangelization that the Church has always conducted through missions is to proclaim the gospel and embody that for those who've never encountered Christ before. And so that's usually associated with missionary societies and religious groups and this sort of thing. So that's distinct from the new evangelization. As Pope Paul VI introduced this vision in the early 70s with his important document, Evangelii Nuntiandi, on evangelization of the modern world, he recognized, I think, something that was pretty obvious, and that was how secularization had de-Christianized so many nations, and not just corporate entities like countries, but also individuals and families and institutions. And so the need was recognized, and then John Paul, I think, did a good job in 83 bringing it to America when he spoke to CELEM, the Latin American Episcopal Conference, and announced that need, the need for the new evangelization. But he really targeted 1992. Even back in the 80s, he identified 92 as the official launch of the new evangelization, because he said this is marking the founding and the first evangelizing of the Americas. You go back 5 centuries, and the most populous Catholic countries were Italy and Spain, France and Germany. And 5 centuries later, what are they? Well, they're Brazil, Mexico, and the U.S., countries that didn't even exist, 500 years earlier, and the ones that were the most populous Catholic countries back then are sort of struggling to find their identity now and sort of recover their own spiritual heritage. And so I think the question is, where will we be in 3 or 4 or 5 centuries? And that depends on what we're going to do with the challenge of the new evangelization. But that really was what helped me crystallize what the new evangelization was, because John Paul and Benedict both identified it precisely in terms of re-evangelizing the de-Christianized, or evangelizing the baptized, as Benedict put it in Verbum Domini. And I think that's striking because, then suddenly we realize that the new evangelization is not a program. It is not some agenda with 4 principles that you've got to get through with people wherever you are, on an elevator, on a plane, or a bus. It really is just living the faith in a way that is meant to be contagious, So in the context of friendship, out in the middle of the world, Catholics can really advance the Church's mission of evangelization, at the water cooler, or, over lunch, or just on the ride home, or on a weekend jaunt, to go to a movie or something like that. I think that's what we have to identify as the context for the new evangelization, that it really isn't a method, it isn't a curriculum, it isn't a program, it isn't some magisterial agenda. It's just sort of Catholics living out the joy and the truth and the love and the beauty of the good news. And, you know, nobody thinks you're weird if on Monday morning at the water cooler you mention a movie that was really exciting or some restaurant with fine cuisine where you went, you know, on Friday evening or something like that, or a great book that you're just finishing up. Well, I think the same thing is meant to be true for our faith, that if we bring it up in terms of, hey, you know, I grew up Catholic, I kind of drifted, but boy, I've just come back to discover how meaningful the Eucharist is, for example, or how meaningful the church's teachings are, you know, just for family life or whatever, people might walk away, but they're not going to think that you're shoving your religion down their throat because you're just talking about something that you've come to enjoy a little bit more, the same way it is with anything else in our experience in the world. And I think that's really Main Street when it comes to the new evangelization. So if there are a million Catholics out there, there are going to be a million ways to evangelize in the context of friendship, work, the neighborhood, and that sort of thing.
The focus of your article, then, is the connection between the new evangelization that you're describing, which happens through friendship and through just living out the gospel in one's daily life. How does that then connect to the Eucharist? That's the main point or thrust of your article. What is that connection?
Well, you know, it came to me back in the early 90s when John Paul published an article in L'Osservatore Romano that I mentioned in my article. It was entitled, quite simply, Based the New Evangelization on the Eucharist, which struck me as sort of odd or counterintuitive when I first read through it, thinking as a former evangelical Protestant, you know, how could I evangelize using the Eucharist as a Catholic? Because you go through the four spiritual laws, you know, God loves you, you've sinned, Christ died, now choose to believe, and you can't turn around them and you can't turn around then and invite them to receive First Holy Communion. It's just not right. They're not ready. I tend to think that non-Catholics evangelize in more of a sprint mode, whereas we tend to approach it more as a marathon. It's a long-term commitment. It's based upon a relationship that is formed and that just grows naturally. And so when I began to think about this more, it occurred to me, especially through a contact that I had with an old friend from high school, you know, a fellow who had grown up Catholic, and as a cradle Catholic, I used to kind of target him and his friends in our high school cafeteria. You know, I'd ask him questions like, you know, where in the New Testament do you find the sacrifice of the Mass? Well, that was years before. I'd forgotten about it until I came across this friend in an airport, and when he saw me, he was so excited because he wanted to tell me the good news that he was now an evangelical Bible Christian. And I looked at him and said, well, this might surprise you, but I'm now an evangelical Bible Catholic Christian, you might say. And he was quite shocked. And suddenly he was turning the cafeteria tables right around on me, saying, okay, wait a minute now. You know, the questions you used to pose to me, I'm going to pose to you. You know, where in the New Testament do you find the sacrifice of the Mass? And over the course of months, we not only got into a good discussion, but we renewed our friendship by phone. You know, we got to visit. And it was that's when I really began to see how the Eucharist could not only be the context for communion in the church for people to come back home, but how the Eucharist was sort of a light that would illuminate the gospel. You know, I said to my friend Chris, you know, you're right that, you know, Calvary is the sacrifice. I'm not denying that now that I'm a Catholic. I would just say this, that when you go back to the first century, if you were standing there on Golgotha, you know, you and your fellow Jewish friends would not have gone home and recounted to your family members that what you had witnessed earlier that day was a sacrifice, because as good Jews, you'd know that sacrifices had to be offered inside of Jerusalem in the temple upon an altar with a Levitical priest standing by, whereas all of that action was taking place, you know, outside the city walls where there were no temples or altars or priests standing by to offer a sacrifice. So I said, Chris, you know, what the early church fathers showed me is that any Jew standing there would have not described Calvary in terms of a sacrifice, but a Roman execution, plain and simple. And so the question becomes, how does a Roman execution suddenly get turned into not only a sacrifice, but the supreme sacrifice of all times? And that's where the Eucharist, I think, really holds the key. Because I explained to him what the fathers had shown me, Ambrose and Cyril of Jerusalem, that it's only when you back up and look at Calvary in the light of the Eucharist, when you look at what happened to Jesus on Good Friday in the light of what he had done on Holy Thursday, that you begin to see the mystery of the cross in terms of not the loss of life, but the gift of life. When he's instituting the Eucharist in the upper room, he's establishing, as it were, the Passover, the new covenant. And the Passover, of course, was always a meal, but it started off as a sacrifice. And so the meal aspect was a sacrificial communion. So in the context of establishing the Passover, the New Covenant, by instituting the Eucharist, he is saying things that must have baffled these disciples. You know, this is my body which will be given up for you. This is the cup of my blood, the blood of the New Covenant. And so I just pointed out to Chris again what the early fathers were showing me years before, that this sort of rhetoric, this sort of, you know, ritual must have bewildered them until the next day when they realized that it was more than rhetoric. It was more than ritual. There was a reality, a mystery to what he had been doing with them, that he really was giving himself on Thursday. He wasn't losing his life on Friday, that he was more of a victim of divine love that is life-giving than Roman injustice that was barbaric. And so I just tried to show Chris that, hey, only when you see that the Eucharist is more than a meal, that it really is the sacrifice of the New Covenant Passover, the only occasion when Jesus even utters the term covenant or New Covenant, then and only then do you really begin to make sense out of how Calvary is the consummation of that sacrifice. Because if the Eucharist is just a meal, I said, then Calvary is just an execution. But if, in fact, the Eucharist is the Passover, the New Covenant, then you can see that the sacrifice that is initiated on Holy Thursday is precisely what's consummated on Good Friday. And then, in turn, Easter Sunday is what transforms that sacrament into a sacrifice, because now his body is no longer bleeding, it's no longer buried, it really is communicable, it's distributable. It's not only deified, but it's deifying to those who receive it in the breaking of the bread. And over the course of weeks, in fact, it was really over the course of months in these conversations that Chris came to realize that, you know, the deeper you go into sacred scripture, the more you read the new in light of the old and vice versa, suddenly the Eucharist is really what illuminates the mystery of the cross, not in terms of God venting his wrath, in terms of penal substitution, but in this display of the mystery of love that is life-giving. And I think it took altogether well over a year, maybe a year and a half. And then, to my surprise, one day he just called me to tell me that he and his wife had just returned to confession for the first time in 30 years, and they couldn't wait to get back tomorrow morning for the Sunday Mass to receive Holy Communion for the first time in three decades. And that's when it really hit me that, you know, yes, indeed, we can base the new evangelization on the Eucharist, you know, not just in terms of, you know, doctrinal propositions or, you know, a series of syllogisms or arguments, but in the context of friendship, communion, but at the same time, the light that the Eucharist illuminates, it transforms our understanding of Calvary. And so at so many levels, I find that the new evangelization can indeed be based upon the Eucharist in a way that is profound and practical.
The understanding of the Mass as both meal and sacrifice, and as worship, you know, sometimes I think about how I think these different dimensions of what Mass is, you know, results in liturgical differences and tensions amongst Catholics. So I'm interested in your thoughts on, you know, what the relationship is between the Eucharist and the liturgy, depending upon, you know, what somebody might emphasize or what's most important, and how those three are really need to be held together in the Mass. What are your thoughts on that?
Okay, well, I approach this from an evangelical perspective. As a Presbyterian, it was the Lord's Supper, so it was always a meal. And yet, at the same time, I grew up in Pittsburgh, where Bishop Wright was, you know, and I remember the corpulent Cardinal Wright being quoted as saying, a meal, well, it's hardly a snack, you know. And, I, you know, that's funny, but at the same time, I found it luminous, because, you know, you look at that and you realize, okay, in some ways it's more than a meal, it's a sacrifice. In other ways, it's much less of a meal, because it really isn't clearly there as a banquet in any conventional sense. And so that's what really motivated me to go digging. And I remember reading De La Taille, The Mystery of Faith, and I found in the earlier writings of this great Jesuit at the beginning of the 20th century, he made it so that instead of a tug of war, well, is it a meal or a sacrifice, there was a convergence. These were mutually reinforcing perspectives, that when you approach the Eucharist in terms of the mystery of faith, you realize that, yes, it is a sacrifice. It is the Passover of the New Covenant. But far from diminishing the value of the meal aspect or the friendship or the communion, that's precisely what enriches and deepens it. And likewise, when you see the meal in terms of a sacrificial communion, then it doesn't have to be, you know, a veritable banquet with steak and lobster, because it's nothing less than Christ who extends the spiritual, the sacred kinship, the divine friendship to all of us to share and to enjoy. And so I think in so many ways, if you approach the Eucharist in dialectical terms, you're always going to kind of feel like it's an either-or. But the Catholic tradition just always sort of approaches things in terms of the et-et, you know, the both-and. And then you realize that it is a sacrifice, therefore it's a meal, but it's also a meal, therefore it starts off as a sacrifice, and, you know, it's a kind of symphonic enrichment, instead of being mutually exclusive, these things are complementary and mutually reinforcing.
You mentioned our new Pope at the beginning of your article, and that his outreach thus far has really been an embodiment of the new evangelization. So I'm interested to know what you mean by that and what you've seen in him in these early weeks of his pontificate.
Well, I would say that, you know, in the early weeks of his pontificate, Pope Francis embodies this sense of friendship. And I think, you know, when we see him, you know, not only as Pope Francis, but, you know, when we see him in Buenos Aires, the photographs of him on the subway, or him paying his hotel bill at the Casa del Clero, or canceling his own newspaper delivery, you get a sense that here's a man who lives in the world and loves the world and is at home in the world, and he embodies that kind of friendship and even models the sort of holy secularity that I think is the genius of the Catholic tradition, of our Church. One of the key insights, I believe, in Vatican II is the secular character of the laity, that we are called to be in the world and love the world as God did. And I think it's an important distinction to make for the new evangelization, because today I think many people in the media portray Catholics as anti-science, anti-culture, anti-art, anti-woman, you name it, and they think we're against it. And yet Catholics know deep down, instinctively, that's not the case. But they're not often trained in making these distinctions, and so, you know, you encounter certain of our co-religionists who might be fearful of the world and wonder what's right. But I think the best antidote to secularism or the secularization of society is precisely the kind of healthy Catholic secularity you find taught in Vatican II and embodied by Catholic lay people, but also now by Pope Francis. He's just so at home in the world with people, the rich, but also especially the poor. And I think he's just opening doors for people to look through and realize, you know, we've really swallowed a bunch of caricatures here. We have to go back and rethink what it means to be Catholic, not only for non-Catholics, but also for us.
Professor Scott Hahn's article is the cover story in this week's America magazine. It's titled Mass Evangelization, Sharing Faith with the Eucharist. Check out his latest book, which is published by Doubleday, Consuming the Word, the New Testament and the Eucharist and the Early Church. Dr. Hahn, thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome, Luke. It's been a delight.